Welcome to the SBK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I will be your host the next 15 minutes. We're coming live from the city of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. Tonight's show is going to have a slightly different format. We have a special guest on the show today, a guest who I've wanted on the show for a little while now. And while we were in San Francisco for the EOS Hackathon, we decided the time was now. So I'm proud to announce that we have on the show today Jay Chong. Jay, for those who don't know, is a co-founder of HK EOS, one of the EOS block producers. He's also a senior EOS developer on Cloak, amongst many different things which you're going to find out over the next 40 minutes. So let's get down to business and let's jump straight into the interview. So on the show today, we have Jay Chong. Jay, for those who don't know, is co-founder of HK EOS, one of the block producers based out in Hong Kong. He's the senior EOS developer for Uncloak. He is one of the most experienced and most talented EOS developers out there. I know he doesn't love praise, so I know he's going to disagree with that. But Jay, how's it going? Thank you so much for making on the show today.
Thanks for the intro, Charles. Just really happy to be here and to have this conversation with you guys.
Absolutely, dude. So we met, I've known about you for a while, but we met in San Francisco. And since we met, I really wanted to know your story because there's a lot going on. You're such an impressive dude. I really wanted to find out more just about you as a person. And I'm really looking to dive deep today.
Yeah.
And I'm looking, I think the best place to start, Jay, is where did it all begin? Where were you born?
I was born in Korea. And then when I was 5, moved to Shanghai, lived there for a couple of years, and then moved to Hong Kong, which is where I spent most of my life. And right now I'm based in Philly. And yeah, that's basically where I've been throughout my life.
Great. And what was the reason for moving, South Korea to Shanghai? What was the reason for the move?
Yeah, I mean, I was really young, so I was just a kid, so I don't really remember what was going on, but I mean, probably just my parents' job. My dad basically had his own trading company, so it felt better for him to be in China where a lot of his deals were.
And what kind of trading was he doing?
Trading like chemicals, basically, and doing a lot of like shipping and everything. So it's good where there are harbors.
Wow, that sounds kind of impressive, dude. And was that something that kind of inspired you to want to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, like, basically, since I was young, like, my dad and I, we hung out a lot, and like, it's always a competition, you know, son and father. I mean, like, even though he's so much older than me, even when I was young, let's say we're playing a game of chess, he would never lose in purpose to me, you know. He would never let me win. If he could win, he always took the chance to beat me. So that sort of like fired up the competitive mindset inside me from a very young age, I think. And he's a great entrepreneur, great guy. So I got to beat him.
I love that. And when did that kind of competitive nature really start coming out? When did you kind of notice that you had that?
I mean, probably throughout high school, it really started like showing in me. You know, sort of garnering that drive and trying to, you know, learning about everything, trying new stuff, and really seeing like what I enjoyed and what I was passionate about, and then really putting my time into it. I guess like those few years were where I was really trying to delve into what interested me, and then trying to focus on that.
And how did you do at high school? Were you a good student? Did you do well?
Yeah, I mean, I did fairly well in high school. Like in terms of school, like I did get pretty good grades in school and everything. But like my focus wasn't just to go to school and sit in the classroom and just do everything I was told to do, you know? I really wanted to like get out there and figure out what I really liked doing and enjoyed doing. And then work on those skills. So, I mean, it was pretty rare. Like, I don't really know, like maybe one or two other guys that actually knew how to program in my high school. for real. But, you know, I just felt like coding was a way to get out there from an early age and, you know, learn about technology, what the most cutting edge things are today. And, like, I just found it very enjoyable. So I really got into it.
Yeah. So what age were you when you kind of found coding in itself? What was one of the factors as well? Was it, did you find it through books? Was it an interest through computers? What really got you into it?
I mean, like, I've always liked technology. Like, I was a huge video gamer back when I was in school, like back when I was in middle school, high school. So I always like thought that programming was all about like building games, you know? And basically when I was like 14, I just searched up on Google, like how to code, just out of curiosity. And then I ended up like going on some like online education platforms like edX, and then just taking a free like video course there on like how to write Java. So Java was actually my first language, and I'm still pretty comfortable with Java, except there aren't like as many uses to it now, I think, compared to some of the other languages that are more practical, especially in like a startup environment. But yeah, I still love Java. It was my first language. I went on to like C++.
Just out of interest, I mean, how long did it take you to get comfortable with Java?
I mean, I'd probably say like to just get the whole gist of it, it took me like 5 months, 4 or 5 months, because it was like my first time trying to program and learning a language. So, I mean, it didn't come to me like super quickly. It wasn't like an overnight thing. Obviously, you got to put in time, try to understand how things are working. And like the thing about programming is, honestly, like, yeah, there are great books out there, but you actually got to just like try writing shit. And like, even if it breaks, like you got to keep debugging it yourself and try to figure out how to make it work. And then like, that's the best time when you learn. That's how to accelerate growth and just really figure out how like actually understand how things are working in terms of like the compiler, how things are running, like when the program actually starts and everything. I think that like debugging is where you learn most.
So you were 14 and a half, 15 when you're pretty much comfortable with Java. What was going on with the other side of your life? So if your academic life, was that kind of not of interest to you now that you found kind of a new world and a new passion, a new outlet? Or were you still in the position where you were maintaining good grades and also creating cool stuff on the other side? So really having a split.
Yeah, I mean, like, definitely it was I was very busy because I was trying to do both at once. I definitely did manage to still do pretty well in school. But I guess like for me, it's always been about like focusing on what I'm really passionate about and like just trying to get really good at that. And at that time, like I was opening my eyes to like entrepreneurship, how like companies actually work. And I felt that it was like very different from a classic traditional academic setting. And like, it doesn't mean I completely dropped school, you know, like I still put in work into it, but my interest definitely lied in real like practical work, I guess, from that point on.
And when you say you got good grades, like what kind of grades were you looking at?
Like, I mean, A's mostly. I got into Wharton, so I mean, I did have a very good GPA getting out of high school.
That's amazing, dude. So after when did you finish high school? In the UK, we don't have high school. So what age were you when you finished that?
I was 17 when I graduated from high
17,
school.
17, got it. And you were mentioning you were looking at entrepreneurship, you were looking at businesses, how they really run. Who were some of your biggest inspirations? Was there anyone that you particularly followed or anyone you particularly kind of drawn towards in the entrepreneurship world?
So like, actually it's funny because the entrepreneurs I was looking at was like probably in the beginning, mostly like my dad, who isn't really into tech. It's more like a trading business, which is like in more, I guess, traditional industries. the stuff I was actually interested in and like getting into with coding was like, you know, new technologies, startups that were based in Hong Kong, basically trying to build around it. And basically how it all started, I guess my first business was my friend and I, we wanted to throw a hackathon at our school. So we started doing that. And then like we talked to like AT&T and who was like, who had good relations with our teachers. So we got, you know, we got into a meeting or a call with him and just like talked to him about our idea. He wanted to sponsor it and like throw an IoT hackathon with us. And that was sort of my first, I guess, experience running something like that. And then, you know, after that, we thought that, yo, we can make money off of throwing hackathons, which was, right now I think is a pretty stupid idea. But I mean, we tried for a couple months trying to just be the ones that ran kick-ass hackathons in Hong Kong. Obviously, like we didn't end up making a lot of profit. And then we pivoted into trying to create like a platform for developers so that they could really show their code and show their work in order to get recruited by some good companies. And like we built a prototype of that platform and everything. But eventually, like we decided to, you know, drop that first company because it wasn't going extremely well.
How old were you when this was going on? 15. And you were, so you just mentioned that you're trying to get people employed as well. So you're having like a value add for the developers and the reason for them to come down to the hackathons.
Yeah, basically it was like we wanted to make a developer platform for developers to empower developers. And I think the slogan on our first page was stop wanking, start coding. And yeah, I mean, we were just two teenagers trying to put stuff together. It was definitely a big mess, but I mean, it was a fun experience for sure. Met some great people, and yeah.
So talk to me. So you at being 15 years old, you reached out to some of the companies in Hong Kong that were looking for developers, and you built up relationships with them. Were they sponsoring you to do the events?
Yeah. So, I mean, AT&T sponsored us for our first hackathon. We tried to do one with General Assembly. We did one with a co-working space called Paperclip. And then we even got to do one with Cathay Pacific.
Wow. And did you make any money?
As I said, we were never really profitable. It ended up being like they paid for all the expenses for the hackathon, but like our staff, meaning us, didn't really get paid an additional, you know, part for running those events. But like for us, it was really like, okay, we gave up on making money off of the hackathons idea a long time ago. The hackathons really became like a way for us to grow our developer network and grow our connections in Hong Kong in order to like show our brand name and try to onboard people onto our platform really, because we were really trying to roll out that platform as soon as possible.
That's amazing. But, because
I mean, like we got the platform done.
You were 15 when this was going on, right? So you're still full-time at school, and then now you're running a business organizing hackathons. And what ages were the developers coming through?
The developers that we were working with, I mean, all of them were like, at least 23, 24 probably. We had someone working for a company who was a master's student in computer science from HKU. And yeah, like we were working with definitely like real developers that were in Hong Kong. We were trying to find the best talent and try to connect them with startups that were looking for rock stars, basically.
So what happened after high school? What went on after that? So your business had finished by then, right?
Yeah, I mean, that one was like pretty short-lived. It was like 9 months, probably. And then when I was, when I was 16, I tried another gig, which was like, I was trying to build a platform where it's a P2P platform like Airbnb, but then it's for self-storage space. So like physical storage, let's say you get off at London Airport and you have like 9 hours in London, right? And you don't want to carry your luggage around. So you could get on this app, find a space literally 2 minutes from you, drop your stuff off there, and then hang out in the city for the rest of the time, sort of thing. We found a couple of use cases for it. And like we built this pricing algorithm that basically makes it so that your rates are cheaper than like the traditional storage options, where like, for example, if you wanted to store a bike somewhere for 2 months, you'd rather buy a new bike because the storage costs more than the bike itself,
right?
Sort of thing. So we were really trying to change that sort of storage industry. And we built out a prototype for this platform as well. It was a lot of fun. Like, I really liked that idea. And then after that, I ended up getting recruited into
what
different
startup.
And then,
what happened?
So yeah, I mean, like we built it out, but we never really, like, the team was all spread out throughout the world. Well, my team is spread out throughout the world right now, but like for that startup, it was all like the rest of my co-founders were also in school. So they weren't willing to put enough time into it. Like, we were going to raise money, but there wasn't enough like momentum, I guess, after we built out the prototype. Like, things just fell apart, I guess, which sometimes happens with these businesses. So
what was the name of that?
It was called Spare. We did incorporate a company. We had it up on spare.ly until probably just like half a year ago when we finally just took it down completely.
So what went down after that? So you recruited to a different startup?
Yeah. I mean, like, basically I ended up working as a junior developer at two other startups. And then the most recent one, basically, it was both in Hong Kong, but I was working at a place called Jobable. And for this one, like, I actually went in, and it was for a blockchain project that they were thinking of starting up, right? And it happened to be, you know, into EOS when EOS was like very hot in the news during its ICO and everything. So I was basically in that co-working space working on servers and configurations and all of this like infrastructure stuff. And then I basically in that co-working space found another guy who was interested in really like, you know, putting in some more time into this blockchain project. And the same startup, I met Hugo, who was the head of UI UX at the time. And we were just like, hey guys, let's just do it. Let's actually try to pull this off. So that's how HK EOS was born. And then, like, along those lines, we also met Devin, who's another one of our partners right now. He worked at Morgan Stanley. He's more of a traditional banker, finance guy for us right now. I mean, it was just a very well-balanced team. And I've been having
That's
a
amazing.
Great time.
So before you started HK EOS, which is one of the EOS block producers, how were you introduced to blockchain? Like, what was the story? Was it you were told about it and then kind of fell down the rabbit hole? Or was it something that you just got straight away?
So actually, like, the first time I looked into Bitcoin was probably in 2015. So while I was doing all that hackathon stuff, I was reading about Bitcoin because it's like, I just found it pretty cool. I heard that, like, I don't know, Bitcoin could have been like found during a hackathon, like the actual idea of it. But so I was like just looking into like ideas, and I just found Bitcoin along the way. I never really understood it until I did some research when I was like 16. I did a like little project on it in school, actually, for an economics class. I just decided to just dive deeply into it because, I mean, what better is there to do than present about tech in an economics class where nobody actually understands tech? So, I mean, I dove into that, and it was a lot of fun. Back then, I think Bitcoin was around $1,700 when I started the project. And then by the end of the project, it was $2,500. And that was a month and a half, right? And I was like, wait, what? This is not how things normally work. So it really perked my interest, but I never actually like had the balls to buy it, you know? Like my friends now are saying, let's just buy one Bitcoin together and see what happens, you know? But like we never ended up doing it. And then like it just rose even more and more. So kind of slapped each other. But
you didn't put the trade on.
Yeah.
So yeah. After starting HK EOS, which is one of the ESPROC producers, what went down next? Because I know at some stage you started working with one of the biggest names in the space, and I'd love to know how that came about.
Yeah, so let's see. I mean, it's only like the beginning of this year when we really got into HK EOS, but it feels like an eternity to me because of everything that's went on since then. So I'll just start with what we did in the early days of HK EOS. I mean, there were so many uncertainties of just being a BP. Like we didn't know if we could get elected. We were trying to bootstrap a business from nothing. And nobody really had a lot of knowledge in the actual EOS software. So like in the earliest days, if you wanted to write a smart contract, there was very little sample code and documentation to go off of, not to mention that everything was always constantly breaking with each update. Love Block One. I mean, they're great guys, but I mean, the environment wasn't great, you know, back in the dawn, 2-3 days. So I was just constantly reading the source code just to figure out how to do things. And at the same time, people were trying to prepare their infrastructure for launch and everything, and nobody exactly knew what the specs would be. And we were very early into the space, and then I started hosting like infrastructure calls. I made a Telegram group for block producers that were interested in discussing about infrastructure, what to do, and like what we need to get set up. And like over time, it actually had a lot of members that started to join. Like some of these calls were great, and I met some really cool guys in the space. We worked in like Jungle Testnet, which Bodon led at the time, and then with those infrastructure calls, we decided to start something called like Ghostbusters, where we created a secure mesh and like did WireGuard meshing between nodes. We started writing like launching scripts, peering scripts. A lot of just cool stuff related with like sysadmin, DevOps, nerdy things. Just living on a server for probably like two straight months doing that. And it was a lot of fun. Got to meet all of these like cool sysadmins and developers in the space and just talk to them. And like it's weird because like we were competing, but we were all like collaborating at the same time. I just felt like the community was great in that EOS environment. And that's where I got to meet guys like Igor from EOS Rio, Michael Yates from DAC, EOS Sweden, and then we all like got together and like really set up this Ghostbusters group that led a lot of the infrastructure and security discussions in the early days. And that's really how our name sort of got out there, being one of the earliest ones in there to lead those technical discussions and help orchestrate that launch of the mainnet in the early days.
So who else were you working for?
I work with the managing partner of Tomorrow Blockchain, Derek, wow. Who's based in Colorado right now. And so basically, if I know correctly, what happened was in January, Block One basically had billions of dollars, and they needed a fund to start off EOS VC, right? And they needed some people that were credible and that had an immense amount of validation, basically. And basically putting, you know, being affiliated with Eric Schmidt's name, that fund, Tomorrow Ventures, was basically their key to, I think, having a very credible EOS VC fund to start with. And I think that's how it came to be. And Derek is currently leading that fund. And I got connected to him basically through one of our earlier partners who used to work at Google Ventures and then worked at Tamar Ventures. And I ended up going to Burning Man with that crew, met a lot of great people, and it was a hell of an experience, basically. But that's where we really connected and started talking. It's been a great time getting to know him and getting to start working with him on some small projects. And basically recently I've started working with them at a little bit of a larger capacity. It's just been a great experience for me to not just be a developer and sysadmin. I do some like business and operational and management stuff for HK EOS, but it's sort of a different kind of
absolutely.
Role, which
I mean,
which is
from
interesting.
And you're doing all of this while at Wharton mm-hmm. Business School as well. So you're doing Wharton Business School. You're mm-hmm. running HK EOS, and you're also assisting where needed at Tomorrow Ventures. So how do you have any spare time?
not a lot. I'm giving up on a lot of sleep, I guess, and a lot of free time. But I mean, I love being busy, and I think there's just so many things going on right now that I want to be as a part of as much as possible that, you know, my bandwidth allows. And like working with Tamar Blockchain is definitely something I'm passionate about right now. I'm extremely passionate about working with HK EOS. Like, it's something that drives me right now. And I just love this EOS community since I jumped in here. All these projects that are going on, it's amazing how all of this can happen in this way. Obviously, like, there are some things that may not be going as ideally. I guess like maybe some of the governance things were quite locked and not moving quickly at some parts in time, but I think this community is great, and we're going in the right direction.
So Jay, how do you see the future, and how do you see EOS's mm-hmm. build out happening? Like, what's your vision? What do you see?
Mm-hmm. So like, I'll talk about sort of maybe the problems first right now. I think some of the problems I see are that companies saw this market go up immensely last year. And what they're like, all of these companies basically started working on blockchain projects. And because they saw that there was a lot of money in the space, and I think because they saw that possibly it was a low-hanging fruit to raise money and get some sort of an investment in if they created a blockchain project. Now, the problem with this is a lot of these projects basically end up being blockchain projects but not having a real reason to be integrated with blockchain technology. And a lot of them are also maybe a little too early for their time, as in the idea is great, but blockchain is still limited. It's still so young right now. And there are some things that just the technology can't really support it very well at the moment. And these companies are trying to make very complex and like substantial tools, which may not be as plausible in like today with how blockchain is right now. But very possible in 1 to 2 years with the speed of growth that's happening at the moment. And like, I can give you some examples for you. Like, for example, right now, the best thing about EOS, I think, is how quick payments are. Transactions are basically like immediate. And any application or platform that needs to integrate extremely quick payments and extremely quick payouts, for example, like rewarding users, it's very, very beneficial to integrate EOS into that exact feature, at least. On the other hand, if you're trying to hide data, or you know, you need to do a lot of things where you need to have some stuff completely invisible from a certain group of people, it may not work as well to be on blockchain because, you know, the data on the chain is all public. So you have to do basically like put a hash on the chain or something, which means you have to run your own centralized database anyway, and everything goes through it. So like, why use blockchain then, sort of thing. There's a lot of types of applications that really make sense to be on blockchain, and another group that does not, basically.
Yeah, I agree massively. And it's like, I don't know who said it, but someone in the space was talking about blockchain being used as magic fairy dust, mm-hmm. right? Any problem that you have, your mom is sick, don't worry, blockchain will fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, your car's out of petrol, put it on the blockchain, totally cool, don't worry about it. And I hear what you're saying there, but I also believe more on the blockchain part that there'll be many different types of blockchains or protocols out there. And if you had one, it would go against the whole philosophy of it. You know, they'd be centralized. So having many different choices and many different systems and protocols out there makes perfect sense, and giving people choice. And as you said, there'll be one for exchange of value. There'll be one for building enterprise level applications upon. So there'll be many different types of protocols out there. So what do you see EOS's real purpose being?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that EOS is really a technology. I mean, EOS.io is a very, like, it's a great blockchain technology that opens doors to a lot of applications for blockchain. I think the EOS blockchain is really one of the first ones to truly be able to host a lot of great decentralized applications for many different use cases. And it's definitely scalable. And there's a lot of great things about it. But I mean, the community still has a lot to do. There are still some features that really need to be built to really be the foundation for future projects. And for example, these could be like one of the biggest things that I'm excited about is inter-blockchain communication, which is basically all these EOS.io based chains can communicate with each other. As in, you can transfer tokens between chains. You can call a smart contract from one chain to another. So if you know, for example, Wurbly is considered a sister chain that uses a very similar, like that uses basically the same software and the same protocol because they're also based on EOS.io. And the mainnet and Wurbly would be able to basically communicate with each other once IBC is implemented, which is just great. And just things like these, basically, I think the focus should be on building these additional, features, additional tools and foundational things first. And then it really opens a lot of doors to building a lot of complex platforms and applications that could really compete with the current traditional existing applications in the market. And what I'm seeing is that right now, like what's successful is a lot more simple dApps that use maybe a little component of blockchain, but isn't completely on blockchain, or it's just really simple enough to be completely on EOS. And like an example is like Pixelmaster. You know, there's a very low barrier to trying it out because you just get on this and there's a canvas with pixels and you can choose a pixel to draw. Like very simple. You just pay and then, you know, that's it. You get to draw. Another thing is probably like EOS Bet. You just get on there, you click a button, and then you're done. You know, they tell you if you won or lost, and then they give you money or you lose money. Simple right. things like these have...
It goes into the simple saying, you know, like keep it simple, mm-hmm. stupid.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I just feel like we're going back to sort of when the internet was like getting started, all these like web games, mini games became a huge thing. It's like similar to that. EOS right now is in its infancy. And the first thing basically people will try will be playing with these pixels and creating these very simple applications and mini games. But the thing is like, it doesn't mean that that's EOS's ceiling. That's blockchain tech's ceiling. I don't think that at all. I really just think that it's part of that growth timeline. In the beginning, it's always going to start like this, you know. We got to make sure that the simple things work and the simple things are built first before you can actually build a lot more of the heavyweight applications in the future.
But Jay, just on a side point, like, how do you think we're doing? We're 5 months into the EOS mainnet being live. Are you happy with the progress we've made so far? I'm aware that there's more to be done, but are you happy with what's happened so far? Are you happy with where we're at? Or do you feel that we haven't achieved what we should have within 5 months?
So I think that like looking at, I mean, compared to other protocols and other, you know, traditional companies, I mean, the power of this community is so strong because there's so many people working on it with different incentives from different environments with different skill sets. We have just a great balance and mix of people that are just doing a great job in doing what they're good at. And like, for example, in our community, we have guys like EOS New York, who's really into the governance and provides very good material for the community to digest. And then we have guys like EOS Rio, DAC. I mean, DAC's creating a DAC, like the first DAC on EOS, which is great. Rio and Sweden, they're great infrastructure guys, same as like Block Matrix. We have like EOS 42 and Tribe that made Chintai. You know, everybody's like doing their part in some capacity or the other. Like EOS Cafe and us, we made a block explorer for the community, and like these are tools that they're doing for the love of the community, because they're giving back as block producers, right? And not just block producers, we have extremely great developers like Nathan James, Cesar, just to name a few, who have been doing an awesome job just providing great material and code to build on top of this community. On the other hand, I think there are also people that could do a better job, that could pull more of their weight and try to really contribute more to the community instead of just thinking about the direct benefit that they get from building something. But,
and
you know,
you're referring to block producers then, right?
Yeah, I mean, block producers mostly. I mean, I don't want to, you know, direct anything to certain people. But like, I mean, that's just true with, I guess, any group in any community. There's definitely going to be some groups that work harder and do more work. Others probably will not. But at the end of the day, I just think like it's still only, you know, 6 months. I mean, 5 months in. We haven't seen what everybody's capable of. We need to give them a little more time. And I think basically over time, like this, the system may have its flaws, but the market, if it's left to be free, will sort of balance itself and really flush everything out eventually. And that's really what I believe in.
Yeah, I love that, dude. Mm-hmm. So what's going on at the minute, man? Like, what are we looking at? What are you doing on a daily basis? How are you dividing your time up between Wharton, between HK EOS, between Tomorrow Ventures? Like, how does a normal day look for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like,
when do you get up?
Basically, I get up at probably like 10 a.m., 10:30. I go to sleep at like 4 a.m. So I get a solid like 6 hours usually. And basically what I do is I usually spend around, let's see, probably 10 hours a week now on servers, just maintaining them, configuration, testing, all of this stuff. And then I spend probably another like 20 hours a week on development, basically writing smart contracts, also working a little bit on the back end, and doing all of those for internal dApp development projects. And then a lot of meetings, talking with other companies, talking with like early stage dApp developers and startups that, you know, want to do some sort of a deal or, you know, advisory with us, because we have a lot of, we have an incubator, and we also do a lot of advisory deals with these early stage apps. Some of them including, you know, Uncloak, which we're advising at the moment. We're advising a bunch of other projects, and like including L2, Lumios. And yeah, after that, like, I also have meetings and sometimes travel, for both HK EOS and sometimes for Tomorrow. And yeah, that's mostly what my work consists of. And
what about school work?
schoolwork. Yeah, I should probably be putting a little more time into that as well. You caught me there.
That's amazing though. So you get up at 10 a.m. and then what are you doing? You checking emails? Are you calling people? Or do you not really know how your day is going to go down? You kind of wake up and you take it day by day.
I mean, usually like every day I'll have probably at least two calls that I got to do. So usually like I have one in the afternoon, one at night, sort of thing. That's how I like to schedule things. So yeah, I wake up. I normally don't make it to my morning classes because I need to eat and just like look at my email, like maybe have a call and start getting into the work vibe. And then I usually make it to like my afternoon classes. And then I guess from like usually 6 to the rest of the night, I'm trying to grind out some real work, just sit down, listen to some music and just focus. And I like working at night normally because that's when it's a little more quiet and less hectic. So I get a lot more consecutive hours, you know. I'm not like in the middle having to stop working and go to a class, or in the middle I stop working and like go eat with friends, you know. I don't get bothered in the middle. I can just really dig in for several hours in a row. I think that works best for me. And I just work until like 3 or 4 usually.
I love that, dude. I love that. Well, while we have you on the show, if people want to find out more about yourself, if people want to find more about HK EOS, what should they do? Where should they go? Is there a Telegram group they can join?
Yeah, so we have a Telegram group called Hong Kong EOS, which is for a block producer. We also have a website called hkeos.com where you can find most of the information. And for any dApp developers or early stage startups that are looking for advisory and or funding, they should definitely look into hitting up hkeos.com or officialdia.com, which is a incubation association we created with EOS Canon and EOS Sys.
Awesome. Listen, Jay, I just want to say on behalf of all of SVK Crypto, we love everything that you're doing, dude. We think you're an absolute gentleman and an absolute player in the game. So keep rocking it, keep doing what you do. And we look forward to hearing all the successes and the future successes that you're going to be having, man. And we're going to have you back on the show very soon.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, buddy. Thanks so much. I want to say a big thank you to Jay for making it on the show today. We really appreciate your valuable time and insights as always. And remember, if you haven't already, to hit us up on Telegram, SVK Crowd. Hit us up on Twitter at SVK_crypto. And if you have any questions or queries or a project you'd like us to see, feel free to email myself, cstory, cstory, at svkcrypto.com. That's a wrap, and I got to bounce.
Listening to an SVK Crypto Podcast original. Follow us on Twitter at SVK_crypto. Email us on cstory@svkcrypto.com. Leave us a message on our website www.svkcrypto.com.